Attorney John Loftus. Mr. Loftus served as a Supreme Court prosecutor during the Carter and Reagan administrations. He was assigned to the Nazi War Crimes Unit. He later discovered that the war criminals he'd been assigned to prosecute were actually working for Allied intelligence. Once he made this discovery, Mr. Loftus exposed the scandal on 60 Minutes. He's authored several books, including Spying on Zion and The Bolero Secret. He is currently working on a new book titled The Secret War Against the Jews. Please join me in welcoming Attorney John Loftus.
Doesn't it seem silly to have an Irish Catholic talking about what the Nazis did to the Jews?
I got into this quite by accident. I was a young lawyer working for the Attorney General in Washington, and President Carter asked the Justice Department to set up a Nazi hunting unit. Well, I knew nothing about the subject, but I immediately volunteered. I thought, you know, hey, look good in my resume, and I might get a free trip to Germany out of it. Unfortunately, my first boss had other ideas. He learned that I had some intelligence training when I was an Army officer, although many people think that military intelligence is a contradiction in terms. In any event, he had a different job. I was to work with the CIA and the NATO intelligence agencies to see if we could find any leads to where there might be Nazis hiding in America. So instead of getting to go to Germany, I got to go to Suitland, Maryland. It's a nice little town right outside Washington. And that's where the government's secrets are buried, literally. There are 20 vaults underground. Each vault is 1 acre in size. You know, 400 or 500 feet deep, filled floor to ceiling with classified documents. Have you ever seen the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark? Well, the last scene of the movie is what the vaults are really like, only not as organized. And being a typical lawyer, I was just stumbling around and too proud to ask directions. And I wandered into the Q vault where the nuclear warfare documents were stored. And I came across a group of files that I wasn't supposed to see, that no one was supposed to see until the year 2015. They were the classified records of the Holocaust. Contrary to public opinion, the U.S. government knew all about it. We were receiving accurate weekly totals of the number of Jews being killed as early as September 1941. The body counts were verified by the British Secret Service, the Polish Underground, and the Vatican. To his credit, Roosevelt did make a covert appeal to the Allies that they should do something about the Jewish problem. The British flatly vetoed any rescue attempts. The British said if the Allies appeal to Hitler to release the Jews from the concentration camps, he'll probably do it. And then the British wanted to know, where would the Jews go? They couldn't go to Palestine. That was a British colony. That might offend the oil-producing Arab neighbors. Roosevelt couldn't get any Jews into America. The U.S. Congress had a very unusual quota system. As a matter of fact, the Congress was pretty much reflective of the American population. Just before Pearl Harbor, nearly 40% of the American public wanted to ban every Jew in America from owning real estate, our own little version of the Nuremberg Laws. Congress reflected the mood of the times. Roosevelt knew he could not get a single Jew into the United States. And so as the inmates of Auschwitz watched in horror, Allied planes flew overhead and dropped their bombs on routine industrial targets further north. The Jews were expendable to the war effort. Roosevelt did manage to extract at least one promise from the British that after the war there would be some sort of Nuremberg trial to try the major war criminals. Saw a lot of things in the vaults that absolutely terrified me. I always had an Eagle Scouts view of America. I never realized that a tiny section of our State Department was almost officially anti-Semitic. I remember I was down in the vaults where the State Department files were, and they had this one big top-secret dossier marked Zionism, so I immediately opened it up and started to read it. And on top was a telegram from the State Department to President Harry Truman, warning President Truman that he must never allow the Jews to have their own country because Israel would be a communist puppet state within 3 years. You know, fortunately, Harry Truman ignored that advice. But Truman had his own problems. Even after the war, when the Holocaust was starting to become known to the general public, Congress still wouldn't let Jews in. I remember reading in my own Justice Department files the reports of the Attorney General at the time, his top secret correspondence to the White House. And the Attorney General said to President Truman that for 3 years in a row, Congress has refused to pass any refugee legislation for fear it would let too many Jews into the country. So the Justice Department came up with a secret quota. What they did was they wrote the law to restrict visas. 80% of the visas would go to persons with agricultural backgrounds. And this would effectively exclude almost all of the Jews who had urban professions who came from urban areas. The Attorney General urged Harry Truman to sign the bill anyway, because that represented the largest number of Jews that Congress was willing to accept. Truman did sign the bill. That's how the Displaced Persons Act was passed. You know, look, working down those vaults for a couple of years, I got the feeling that one-third of modern history was classified. And the more I poked around there, the more the people would come up. Some of the old spies that worked in the vaults would say, "I know what you're doing. Don't tell my boss I told you. But here are some files you want to see." And they kept leading me deeper and deeper in the vaults. It was like a Conrad novel. And then I realized just how sensitive this whole thing had become. I found out, much to my horror, that many of the Nazis I'd been assigned to prosecute were already on the government payroll. Not that this was a U.S. government program. This bizarre little story happened like this. At the end of World War II, the British Secret Service decided, well, the Germans are defeated now. The Russians are our enemy. And who better to recruit to fight the Russians than those very Nazis who fought against them on the Eastern Front? We've got Eastern European fascists who speak the local language. We've got SS intelligence people who are trained in the areas. These guys could be our underground freedom fighters. We'll build an entire underground army of fugitive Nazis that we can put in cold storage to come back and work for the liberation of Russia. And as a Roman Catholic, it embarrasses me to admit this, but the British Secret Service went to the Vatican and asked Pope Pius XII if he could set up a smuggling system for these freedom fighters. And a network of convents and monasteries and safe houses was set up, running from Germany to Austria to Italy, and thousands of people were smuggled out. U.S. intelligence burglarized the Vatican in 1947, and we found out about it. And that's where things got really crazy. A small group of officials in our State Department were secretly working with the British Secret Service behind President Truman's back. They were committing mutiny, guys like Alan Dulles. And they were bringing the Nazis in. The British were saying, hey, these guys are terrific. They're going to be the best agents against communism we've ever had. We've just got to hide some of them in Australia and some in Canada. And won't the U.S. take some in? And we said, sure. So here's a completely legal program. The CIA didn't know anything about it. The president didn't know about it. Congress didn't know about it. But our State Department had people like Alan Dulles who were on Dewey's campaign. They thought that Dewey was going to be Truman in 1948. So what if they'd been a few rules? So they told their counterparts in British Secret Service, go ahead and send the Nazis in. Well, there are a few things wrong with the program. The first thing was that the British genius who thought up this idea of using Nazis as freedom fighters was a British agent by the name of Kim Philby. Some people get the joke. Okay, Kim Philby was the highest-ranking communist spy ever to penetrate the British Secret Service. During all those years that he was running the Nazi recruiting program, Philby was working for Moscow. And the Kremlin was telling Philby, go ahead, see if those gullible Canadians and Americans will take the Nazis in. You know why? All during World War II, Soviet intelligence had infiltrated every one of these Nazi groups in the Eastern Front. We weren't getting freedom fighters. We were getting the dregs of the war criminals, many of whom were double agents. They'd work for anybody who'd pay them just to keep their neck out of the gallows. So Philby kept sending the Nazis in. And there were some gullible nitwits in this country that fell for it. And I was reading their names in the files. The British counterpart in America was a young New York lawyer named Bill Casey. He headed up an organization called the International Rescue Committee that met the Nazis in New York and resettled them. Now, they had, the money was coming from CIA money laundered through the state. CIA didn't know where it was going, but so they had a private front group set up called the Crusade for Freedom. And that was how to disguise how the Nazis were being paid and resettled. And the spokesman for the Crusade for Freedom was a young movie actor named Ronald Reagan. Now, Reagan didn't know that he was part of a covert op to launder money to Nazis. But here I am, finding these files, and Ronald Reagan has just been elected president of the United States and appointed Bill Casey as head of the CIA. And Casey knew what was going on. Now, my first instinct as a good lawyer was to cover my ass. Simply close the doors in the vaults and go back to my nice career as a Justice Department prosecutor in Washington and forget what I had seen. But I knew if I did that, that in about 35 years from now, all of the Nazi records would be declassified and turned over to the National Archives. And someday, my daughter would come to me with these records in her hand and ask me why I did nothing when the Nazis were still alive. I feared that I would give her Dante's answer, that the seventh circle of hell is reserved for those that had the ability to prevent evil but did nothing. I thought she deserved a better answer than that. I think we're a better country than that. Besides, I knew that I had seen something in those vaults that would haunt me for the rest of my life. I'd come across the memoirs of a Jew. His name was Solomon. Saul was one of 50,000 Jews from the city of Baranovich in what is now the country of Belarus, a little border state between Poland and Russia. It used to be the most densely populated Jewish settlement on the face of the earth, from Vilna in the Baltics down through Minsk and Baranovich in Belarus down to Pinsk in the Ukraine. Some of the cities and towns were 90% Jewish. It was a refugee area where the Jews who were expelled from Germany in the 13th century were allowed to settle and live in an area of sanctuary. Well, in 1941, when the Nazis invaded Russia, they went right through Belarus. And in the fall of 1941, the SS became very nervous about this huge Jewish population right behind the German front lines. Now, the SS had recruited local collaborators, and one of them was an educated man, Dr. Stanislaw Stankovic. Now, Dr. Stankovic had a doctorate of humanities from one of the better Belgian universities. And Dr. Stankovic wanted to get in on the winning side in World War II, so he worked for SS intelligence. But there was a little loyalty test. A young SS officer named Adolf Eichmann went to Stankovic and said, "We want you to conduct an experiment, kind of a pilot project of what would become known as the Final Solution." That was the following year. Stankovic was asked if he could take his police force of native collaborators and take a little town where 8,000 Jews were living and massacre them all in a single day without any help from the Germans. Stankovic thought it over and said that it could be done. On the night of October 19th, 1941, Dr. Stankovic threw a wild party for his policemen to get them properly drunk for the work that was to come. At 3 o'clock in the morning of October 20th, the raid began. The 8,000 Jews were taken out 100 at a time to a road near the airport where the ditches had been dug. They were made to disrobe and then climb in the ditches and lay on top of each other head to toe. Stankovic figured he could pack more in that way, and his troops could shoot through a double layer of bodies and save ammunition. A layer of dirt was shoveled over the wounded, a double layer of bodies, a layer of dirt, and so on. Stankovic called it the sardine method. He was very impressed with himself. The worst part of these early atrocities weren't even discovered until after World War II, when American Red Cross doctors were conducting autopsies in the graves. They could find no trace of wounds upon the littlest children. Apparently, to save the price of a bullet, Dr. of Humanity Stankovic ordered that the Jewish babies be buried alive. As a reward for the efficiency with which he conducted this massacre, Dr. Stankovic became the governor of the province of Baranovich. There were 50,000 Jews in the central city alone, some 250,000 Jews in the surrounding area. 6 months after Stankovic arrived, there were only 5,000 Jews left alive in the region. 6 months later, there were only 500. Stankovic kept them alive as skilled laborers in his concentration camp. 6 months later, there were only 126 Jews left. Saul was one of them. This little Jewish barber had lost his wife, his three babies, all his grandparents, uncles, aunts, all 110 members of his family, every friend, every neighbor, every face he had known on the face of the earth was dead. But Saul did an amazing thing. He dug a tunnel under Stankovic's concentration camp and led the last 100 Jews in a breakout. They made it to the swamps and forests of Belarus in the dead of winter, and they joined up with other Jewish fugitives, and they formed a resistance brigade, a partisan brigade, Bielski's brigade. Hundreds of miles behind Nazi lines, this tiny band of young Jewish men and women, most of them would be college age, your age, took up arms and went back and fought against the men that had slaughtered their families. Stankovich put a price of 10,000 marks on Saul's head. Six of the Belarus SS police battalions were assigned to track him down. The Jewish partisans were so adept at blowing up ammo dumps and rail lines that at the end of World War II, Bielski's brigade was the most highly decorated partisan unit on the Eastern Front. But there were only a few dozen survivors. Saul was one of them. Saul knew that there would be no freedom under Russian liberation either. So Saul, together with a young woman whose life he had saved in the camp and who later became his second wife, they took up arms again and they shot their way out of Russia, escaped across Central Europe, and got to Allied lines in Italy. When they got there, Saul was dying. The years of fighting in the underground, living in frozen potato holes in the winter, had taken a terrible toll on his health. The Italian doctors had no time or money for Jewish refugees, and so they threw him an award for the terminally ill and left him to die. And all across America, in communities like this, small groups of Jewish men and women, and with the help of some Christians, collected money to rescue the survivors of the Holocaust. Teams of doctors and nurses were sent to Europe. They located Saul in Italy and nursed him back to health and brought him to America. When Saul got here, he didn't want to put the past behind him. He wanted to say, find some way of saying thank you for the people who saved his life. So Saul sat down and wrote out his memoirs of what had happened to the 50,000 Jews of Veronovich who would never be able to speak for themselves. And Saul gave a copy of his memoirs to our State Department. And the State Department classified Saul's diary and put it in the vaults where I stumbled across it 3 decades later. You know where it was? It was in the Stankovich file. Stankovich was on the U.S. payroll. I couldn't believe it. Stankovich was one of the most famous of the non-German war criminals. His atrocities were read into the Congressional Record of the United States as an example of the sort of non-German murderer who should never be allowed into this country. Stankovich's name popped up at Nuremberg. There were German soldiers who were sickened by Stankovich's atrocities and testified about what he had done. Stankovich's name popped up again in the United Nations. The Soviet delegate got up and made a startling accusation. He accused the governments of Great Britain and the United States of hiding Dr. Stankovich and tens of thousands of other war criminals in our refugee camps in the Allied zones of Germany. Well, the State Department laughed off the charges. This is communist propaganda. It's silly. The U.S. Army didn't laugh. They checked it out. They found Dr. Stankovich, all right. Our State Department had put him in charge of a refugee camp in Germany, in the U.S. zone. Your tax dollars at work. Stankovich was handing out visa applications for his friends to come to America. The Army arrested Stankovich, threw him in prison. He promptly confessed. He had nothing to fear. He sat down and wrote out a list of all the positions he'd held under the Nazis. A few hours later, a State Department officer arrived and ordered Army intelligence to let Dr. Stankovich go. The State Department explained that Dr. Stankovich was an important anti-communist organizer for the British Secret Service. The Army released him. On 6 different occasions, the Army and the CIA teamed up to block the State Department from bringing Dr. Stankovich to America. The CIA pointed out that not only was Stankovich an admitted war criminal, the CIA believed that Stankovich himself was a communist double agent. The State Department laughed off the charges. How could that be true? Everyone knew that Stankovich was a Nazi. Why, Kim Philby himself had personally vouched for Dr. Stankovich. So we got suckered in. On a 7th try, the State Department succeeded. They brought Dr. Stankovich to New York City and gave him a job as a broadcaster at Radio Liberty and arranged for him to become a citizen of the United States under his own name. Stankovich made sure that his friends followed. By 1954, the FBI files were showing that some 3,000 members of the Nazi puppet government of Belarusia had resettled in the United States. Virtually the entire Belarus SS was in this country. I mean, I couldn't believe it. According to these records, most of the Belarus SS was living in a little town called South River, New Jersey. They had a private cemetery for the SS. I actually went there with some bodyguards from the State Department and climbed through the cemetery looking. And there are the names of all the senior officials, and a lot of the guys are still alive. And there's more in the New York area, some in Cleveland, some in Detroit. But they'd resettled the entire Nazi puppet government from this area. I mean, this was a group that massacred nearly 750,000 Jews, 2 million Christians, their own population, and fought against the Allies at Monte Cassino and against the American forces in France. And these were people who had committed despicable war crimes. They were getting government subsidies as an anti-communist underground group. I thought, what a tragedy. The worst part was, Saul had been living less than a half an hour away all this time. Imagine that, almost living in the shadow of the men who murdered his family. Think of that, this heroic Jew who fought against the Nazis and against the communists and came to America to find freedom, only ended up living in the shadow of his killers. It sickened me. I took the diary out of the vaults and showed it to my wife. And she agreed we had to do something. What would you do? I went to the Assistant Attorney General of the United States and asked for permission to prosecute an American intelligence agent for war crimes. Permission was granted. I asked each of the government agencies to try and locate Saul as a key witness, but all the agencies reported back that in view of his age, he was missing and had to be presumed dead. It was sad, but it didn't stop our trial preparations. We rounded up every Nazi document in the world that had ever been written about or by Dr. Stankovich. It was an enormous research job. And you know, Dr. Stankovich was ungrateful enough to drop dead on me 2 weeks before we could file charges against him in the Southern District of New York. He died peacefully in his bed, a citizen of the United States. There was a big sigh of relief at the British Embassy. Stankovich's trial would have been hideously embarrassing for them. And it was suggested to the new Reagan administration that I'd be told to stay out of the vaults, not to bring any more cases like this. And I was told to forget what I had seen. How do you forget about someone like Saul? I told the Reagan administration I would not participate in a cover-up. And I resigned from the Justice Department. I sat down and wrote a book of all these top secret programs. And I dedicated the book to Solomon, a Jew, who bore witness to the Holocaust, and to Maggie, my newborn, so that she may never have to. And I went right back to the Justice Department, the CIA, and asked for permission to publish. You know, a lot of people may knock America, but you live in the only place in the world whose government has the guts to admit its mistakes and correct them. Not that Nazi recruiting was a government program. This was always a small group of officials who were committing mutiny. But this is probably the only place on the planet where my book would have been declassified. I was very proud of the government the day the CIA called and said I could go public. Now, what do you do when you want to go public in America? I pick up the phone and I call 60 Minutes. We had a great time. Mike Wallace gave me 30 minutes on the show, the longest segment they've ever done. Caused a massive uproar. Congress demanded an investigation. Mike Wallace got the Emmy Award. My family got the death threats. It was a great trade-off. I figured, okay, that's it. I've done my duty as a citizen. I'm going to go into private practice and make money as a lawyer. Not so easy. Seems every retired spy in America thought that what I had done was a little stupid but neat, and they wanted me to be their attorney. You see, as a lawyer, I could take their information and keep their identities privileged on the attorney-client privilege, and then go back to the CIA, because everything I write for the rest of my life has to be cleared by the agency, and get some of these stories declassified. So the old spy said, you got to let people know how the Nazis got into America. And I said, no, the CIA has told me I can't write about the Vatican. They said, no problem. Here's how the loopholes work. So it was a riot. We hired a researcher, a young British guy, who spoke Serbo-Croatian, and sent him around the Vatican to tape record the surviving priests who had smuggled the Nazis out. And believe it or not, six of the priests bragged about it into the tape recorder. So I came running back to CIA saying, hey, look, you know, they talked about it now, guys. And I said, all right, get out of here. Go write the book. So my crazy Australian friend and I, Mark Ahrens, we did. We 2 years ago, we came out with Unholy Trinity, which was a history of how the Vatican's Nazi smuggling problems work. I hope people understand that 99% of the Catholic Church is very opposed to doing this. There's a tiny clique of very right-wing Italian cardinals who thought they were helping the British Secret Service, but were really driven from violent anti-communist fears that Italy would fall to the communists after World War II. Much of what has been written about the Vatican is very different from what I read in the intelligence files. It turns out that the Pope actually saved more Jews than all the Allies put together. Yeah. During the war, Pius XII was okay. He was working together on a coup to assassinate Hitler. After the war, what Pius XII did was despicable. They literally set up a smuggling program for Nazis. I know that sounds very bizarre, and you're probably having some difficulty believing it. Let me suggest to you to watch television on May 5th. Sam Donaldson and I will take over the entire hour of Primetime Live. I only do TV shows about once every 10 years, but when I do them, we'll have some fun. All I can tell you is the Argentine government opened up some of their Nazi files, and that was a big mistake. So we'll have some fun on that. And I think you will see a very interesting development on where these guys went. So after I did the Vatican book, I said, okay, now that's it, guys. I'm through. Thank you very much. I'm going back to being a lawyer. Not so fast. They introduced me, the old spies introduced me to the new generation of guys and said, look, you don't understand. This stuff didn't end with bringing the Nazis in. This isn't some weird program that happened back in the 40s and 50s. What we're talking about is a small handful of American officials who work with the British Secret Service to run corrupt programs whenever they want behind Congress's back. For the last 10 years, Mark and I have been doing interviews among intelligence officers. I think we've done about 600 now. In the fall, our new book will come out. It's called The Secret War Against the Jews. And it's a history of Western covert operations against Israel and against American Jews. For years, I had been forbidden to write concerning the fact that we wiretap American Jews extensively. That was censored out of the first two books. It'll be the Clinton administration, apparently, is letting me write about it. It's a very sad story. We started this program in 1944. The British wanted to wiretap those American supporters of Palestine who were trying to send money and guns to the Zionists in Israel. And the FBI played along. The program has run pretty much intermittently since then with its ups and downs. Lately, it's gotten really out of hand. During the Reagan and Bush administration, it got to the point where we're collecting rosters of kids going to Jewish summer camps. Anyone who telephoned someone in Israel, made a donation to a Jewish charity, anyone who proclaimed themselves to be a Zionist, or you've been bugged. So the First Amendment is gone. Forget about privacy. We live in the electronic age. If half the stuff of what the old spies are telling me is true, we have to do some serious rethinking about what we're going to do to save the Bill of Rights in this country. We go into that great deal more detail in the book. I was really shocked. I mean, the old spies may be right that one-third of modern history is classified. I mean, Iran-Contra, right? No one understands it, but all I remember is Israel started sending guns to Iran in 1985, right? Wrong. Vice President Bush started sending guns to Iran through the British Secret Service in 1984. The British agent who handled the transactions died a couple of years ago, and his family sent me all his files. They were laundering the money through a British bank. Guess which bank they used for the arms for hostage stealing? The Bank of Crooks and Criminals International, the BCCI. So we're going to have a lot of fun with the new book. Between the wiretappings and the real story and the BCCI scandal and some stuff in Iran-Contra. But, you know, it's convenient to blame things on Israel. They're convenient scapegoats. Publicly, America is Israel's ally. Privately, we do everything possible to aid the oil-producing Arab nations. And in that sense, we're very neutral. We treat all oil-producing nations equally. Since Israel has no oil, they're screwed. In every war that Israel has fought, United States intelligence agencies have given covert assistance to Israel's enemies in time of war. We have betrayed every secret, every code, every battle plan that Israel has ever possessed. And I think you're going to be surprised to see just how thorough that was. It's nothing anti-Semitic at this point. It's about oil. It's about greed. You know, if Israel had oil, Alan Dulles would have been Ben-Gurion's best friend. In the first third of this 20th century, it was bigotry that was the predominant motive for anti-Semitism. In the middle third, it was greed, the push for oil. I think in the last third, it's just stupidity, that our politicians just don't have the faintest idea what's going on. Some of the things that we've done have been 90% stupidity and 10% conspiracy. Never, ever underestimate the blunders that can be made by a few people who want to usurp the intelligence process. Don't get me wrong. 99% of the people I met in CIA and the other intelligence agencies are good, decent Americans. It's a great career for you. I recommend it. The problem is 1% of the people in the intelligence community who are corrupt, either personally or politically, can make a great deal of money out of working for the intelligence agencies. Intelligence, not oil, not gold, is the most valuable commodity in the world. And for a crook like Bill Casey, it was just feeding at the pig trough. So we've lost track a little bit. But we think we live in an age of documents. There are no secrets anymore, only deferred disclosures. So I've sort of given up trying to be a private lawyer now, and I've ended up being sort of an informal lawyer for spies. And every couple of years, we churn out a new book, and it has to go through CIA, then it has to go through the libel review. The new manuscript coming out, I think we had 700 pages of text and 300 pages of footnotes. It's a laborious, detailed research. It's like doing homework the rest of your life. But I think it's useful, because a lot of these guys will never... I want to interview them before they die. Their institutional memory is sometimes the only way of piecing together what really happened in some of these bizarre events from years ago. And I figure that sometime around the year 2015, the rest of the files will slowly start being declassified. People will see how the pieces fit together. I'm trying to make sure that we just don't simply abandon the Jews again. And people are entitled to have a little piece of the puzzle. Most Americans are good, decent people, but we just don't pay a lot of attention to Jews. Most Americans didn't know diddly about the Holocaust during the war because our own government was sitting on all of the intelligence information about it. We weren't releasing it to the press. We knew it was true, we just weren't releasing it. The same happened in Britain. Churchill's files were beginning to be declassified this year. They're much embarrassed to note that he was receiving his first reports on the Holocaust in 1941 as well. They all knew what was going on. But what do I care? I'm not a Jew. None of my family died in the Holocaust. I wasn't even born during World War II. Why stick my neck out for this? I have a personal reason I'd like to tell you about it. You see, after the 60 Minutes show, I found out the government had made a big mistake. It was Saul. He was still alive. He telephoned me and we became very close friends. My wife and I are virtually the only ones that know anything about what he went through in Belarus. Saul and his wife Helen became very close to my daughter Maggie. She's sort of like an adopted grandkid. And they spoiled her rotten. No one in America knows who he is. He's one of the last real witnesses to the Holocaust in Eastern Europe. He was still living less than a half an hour away from the Nazis in South River. So we asked Saul to quietly cooperate with the government, but to keep a low profile. He's an old man entitled to his privacy. I remember the first time I was down in South River and in a nearby area, I was asked to talk to a group of high school kids about the Holocaust. And these kids were primarily of Eastern European descent. I was talking to them about the Holocaust, and they weren't buying it. Their parents, their church groups, their religious organizations had all taught these children that the Holocaust did not happen. Oh, there were a few Jews killed by the Germans, but none of our people were involved. No Poles, no Belarusians, no Hungarians, no Ukrainians. No, no. You know, I tried to tell the kids that that wasn't true. The SS kept meticulous records. The armies of the Holocaust weren't German. They were local volunteers. There'll always be that sad couple of percentage in each country that's willing to climb to power over the bodies of children if necessary. You know, the guards at Auschwitz and Treblinka and Sobibor, they weren't Germans. They were Ukrainian and Belarusian volunteers. Saul had told me that the only German in his concentration camp was the commandant. Everyone else was a local police volunteer. They got a kilo of sugar for every Jew they shot trying to escape. So I kept telling the kids, the SS had all these documents, but you know, these kids didn't want documents. They had parents who had been there. I wasn't even born during World War II. So they didn't want a bunch of legal mumbo-jumbo on papers. They wanted a witness. And suddenly, Saul stood up in the audience and said, "Tell them tell him who I am. He was willing to sacrifice his privacy, his anonymity, to risk his life again by bearing witness to the truth. It was an act of incredible courage. I've told my daughter, Maggie, there are still heroes in the world because her father met one. Most Americans don't know very much about Saul, but they remember him in Israel. Years ago, the Israeli Secret Service tracked him down and flew him to Israel for the dedication of Yad Vashem, Israel's memorial to the Holocaust. Golda Meir met him at the airport. He's one of the last living Jewish war heroes on the face of the earth. And Saul brought with him a photograph. It was taken of the young kids in the Jewish brigade in the forest. You've probably all seen it. It's part of the famous 12 posters on the Holocaust that ADL and B'nai B'rith have put out. It's entitled The Jewish Resistance. A photo of young men and women in the forest with crossed armbands and rifles. Saul is in the front row, second from the right. Saul didn't want us to prosecute the Nazis out of vengeance, but out of a sense of deterrence. He didn't want what happened to your children, what happened to his. We must stop treating the Holocaust as a Jewish issue. It is the greatest crime in human history. It is part of all of our heritages. The Holocaust was unique. For the first time in the history of mankind, a civilized country decided to exterminate an entire species of the human race, to eradicate the entire gene pool of this particular group, whom they defined as Jews. It had nothing to do with race. Most of the German Jews were white. They intermarried long ago. It had nothing to do with religion. The majority of the German Jews were Protestants or Catholics or seculars. They had long given up the faith. It seems that there is a tradition of anti-Semitism that may have a secular origin. The Jews were the first group to pursue mass literacy. In the year 89 BC, every Jewish village, no matter how small, had to have a teacher. Literacy was a survival skill for a bunch of small nomadic shepherds in between two great kingdoms on either side. The Jews had public health codes, what we've now written down in the book of Leviticus. They recorded all the folk stories of the Middle East, from the Noah flood to the Moses in the basket story, for example, comes from a Sumerian legend 3 centuries earlier. But the version that is saved for us was the one that the Jewish scribes collected and put into the first 5 books of the Bible. So here we have this highly literate culture living in the worst place in the world because they're right between two gigantic cultures and they're living across the land bridge between Asia and Africa. Well, Jews got conquered a lot. And finally, the Romans dispersed the population around the Mediterranean. But wherever the Jews went, they could take their culture with them because they were literate at a time when the Christian priests couldn't read or write. Every Jewish kid over the age of 13 had to at least be able to read and write a little. So it's not surprising whenever you have a tiny minority of, that works hard for education and community support, they're going to do well in any society they land in. That's why we hate them. When the Jews came to this country, they were an embarrassment to the rest of us fat, happy, lazy Americans. Here's a hard-working group of people that came in from Europe, and all of a sudden, within a generation, their kids were going through medical school and law school. It's not a phenomenon restricted to Jews. The Asians now are the new Jews in America. In California, the Asian kids, there's actually discussions about putting quotas on them in colleges. Okay? Any minority group that challenges our traditional way of life by working harder at it is an embarrassment. And in medieval times, that embarrassment was translated into pogroms. In modern times, that embarrassment was translated into the Holocaust. That here was a way of, the Holocaust was the greatest real estate grab in German history. I mean, Hitler saw unemployment by throwing 3 million Jews out of work. Cruel, scientific, organized. Genocide is common to all of our experiences. Now, it's true that there were more blacks killed in the Middle Passage in the 19th century. There were some 10 or 20 millions of blacks who died in the slave boats. But the idea wasn't to exterminate the black race. Blacks were valuable chattels. They were slave property. They tried to keep them alive. A higher percentage of the Armenian race perished in their genocide. Nearly 1 out of 3 Armenians in the world died in World War I. 1 out of 6 of every Jews in the world died during the Holocaust. But the Armenians weren't to be murdered as a race. They were just to be driven off the land. What happened to the Jews is shockingly unique in human history. It was, beyond doubt, the worst crime in human events. I learned a couple of things in the vaults. And the three great evils in this century were communism, fascism, and indifference. And indifference is the deadliest of the three. Are we all of us bystanders? Are we doing what our parents did during World War II? Are we shrugging our shoulders and turning away? What about Bosnia? Have you ever called your congressman? Have you so much as picked up a telephone to say, this is wrong? We must develop more of a moral conscience. It's easy to get emotional calluses from watching television. There are so many sad events going on in so many different places. All I am saying is that we have to draw a line somewhere, that people who murder babies should be hunted for the rest of their lives. That's a crime not against Jews or against Bosnians, but against all humanity. We all have an interest in prosecuting those people. Perhaps if we'd done a better job in hunting the Nazis after World War II, we wouldn't be faced with the evils of Bosnia or the killing fields of Cambodia or the atrocities that occurred in South America that is just now coming to light. We're going to do a better job. But it's hard to do. Let's face it, we've all heard racist jokes, turned away from it. We've all heard people make funny remarks about the Jews. We never said anything. We have to become like Saul, to have the courage to speak out and preserve the truth. Saul was the guy who inspired me. And just before he died, he said something that really sort of stuck with me. He said, John, in this country, you should never be afraid to speak the truth. Thank you for listening. You guys have been very patient. Boy, you give an Irishman a microphone, he just rattles on for a while. Do we have some questions from the audience? Yes, sir. Yeah, the question was the Pollard case an attempt to intimidate the American Jewish community by saying if you release this information, you will be prosecuted to the maximum extent? And I think he's giving the government too much credit. One of the intelligence agents explained the government to me in terms of the African centipede theory. The African centipede has 50 opposing sets of male and female sex organs, and it spends all day screwing itself. That, I think, is a fairly accurate analogy of how our intelligence community functions. And I think it would be wrong to suggest that there was any sort of organized plot. There were some things that happened in the Pollard case, but that's coming out in the new book, okay? The bottom line was that Pollard stumbled across something that he thought was fairly minor. He doesn't even realize the significance of it. Pollard blew the whistle on a shipment coming out of Greece in 1984 that was destined for South Yemen. He thought it was a PLO arms shipment. He was wrong. It was Vice President Bush's first shipment of arms to Iran. So Pollard doesn't know what he knows, but it'll all come up. Pollard is not one of my heroes. Okay, Pollard is a money-grubbing mercenary who's an adrenaline addict and is despised by the Mossad. One of the reasons he is sitting in jail is that Mossad doesn't want him out. They don't want him to return to Israel, sit down and write a book that will cause even worse damage. Pollard wasn't working for them. Pollard was looking for a couple of right-wing politicians in Israel who put themselves above the national interest and ran a hopeless amateur in an operation that embarrassed both countries. No, I don't think a 45-year-plus prison sentence was deserved. But I'm no particular fan of Jonathan Pollard's. But on the other hand, he has been made out to be a scapegoat. He received a disproportionate sentence not because of what he did, but for what the administration feared he might reveal. John Singlob is not an ex-Nazi. There's a good book about it called Inside the League by the Andersons. And they interviewed me for Source for a couple of years ago. Well worth a read. The whole story hasn't come up. We're going to bring a little bit of it in this book. General John Singlob is just a right-wing American nut. Okay? And was in a lot of hot water with Jimmy Carter and and got fired. And he became the head of an organization that's been existing for quite some time. WACL, the World Anti-Communist League, is... I'm not making it up, that's its name, WACL. Originated with a British organization called the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations that was their umbrella group for recruiting the Nazis from 1945 to about 1950. And ABN is to this day one of the biggest sections of WACL. WACL is a wonderful organization. It's the only place in the world we have genuine World War II Nazis, South Asian fascists, South American death squads. All the dregs of humanity have sort of self-identified themselves by their affiliation with WACL. It's a sick little organization. My sources were sending me copies of the WACL convention registers. I don't know, I didn't ask how they got them. But some of the people that are in WACL were senior Nazis in the Belarusian government, for example. Their pictures are in my first book. The head of WACL for a while, the ABN section, was a guy named Mastetsko. He was the head of the Nazi forces in the Ukraine after the war. Got a nice picture of him with John Singlob and Ronald Reagan. John Singlob is just a useful idiot. Okay? He doesn't really know how bad WACL is. He honestly believes that it was purged. The problem was that the Norwegian chapters of WACL a few years back discovered there were so many Nazis running around and a big supposed purge took place. And the problem is it didn't. They stayed very well organized. So yeah, I used to think that there was no link between the old Nazi groups and the new neo-Nazis. Oh no, they are now. Apparently, groups like WACL receive a lot of funding from Saudi Arabia and from Japan. Now think about it. It makes no sense, right? How about in terms of ending America's support for Israel? It makes sense in terms of oil. Funding right-wing groups in the United States is a wonderful lobby for oil companies and oil-consuming nations to stop our policies towards Israel. They pump a lot of money into it. I'm not an expert on WACL, but there are a couple of good books on it, and there's some very, very sick people there. Very sick. Yes, sir?
What happened with
withheld information from a court? As far as I understood, the Russians were telling them, there were two guys, Nikolai and Marchenko, you know. They went to, there's just the same guy, it was just a paper scrub. They made an honest mistake. Here's what happened. There are two camps, Treblinka and Sobibor. Sobibor, the documents show, was where Demjanjuk worked. But all the Jewish witnesses saw him at Treblinka. Okay? Now, what I just found out recently was that the Sobibor camp was shut down for 6 months out of the year. And guess where all the guards went? Up the rail line to Treblinka. Now, so we have the part-time Ivan the Terrible and the full-time Ivan the Terrible running the gas chambers at Treblinka 6 months a year. Guess what? They both had the same name. The full-time guard of the gas chambers was Nikolai Marchenko. John Demjanjuk's middle name is Marchenko. Ivan Marchenko Demjanjuk. Well, all the Jews call all the inmates Ivan. So you have two Ivan Marchenkos. When it was a million and one shot, you had two guards with the same name at the same camp at the same time. He's not going to get away with it, though. The Israelis made a mistake. They only charged him with one camp. In the U.S., we charged him with three camps. Okay, then he went to the SS Guards camp, where the Soviets found his ID card with a photo on it. But forget that. That could have been a Soviet forgery. Then he was at Sobibor, where the German documents show he was located. Well, forget that. You know, there could be a coincidence, a different guy. Except for the fact that John Demjanjuk has a scar on his right shoulder blade, exactly where the Nazi medical records show that Ivan the Terrible was wounded, or Ivan the Not-So-Terrible. He only murdered 250,000 people in Sobibor versus 750,000 in Treblinka. And forget the fact that we had six eyewitnesses that independently picked John Demjanjuk's photo out of a photo spread. What really got me about the Demjanjuk case was when my buddies were putting Demjanjuk on trial in the United States, John Demjanjuk took the stand in federal court and swore under oath that he could never have been running the gas chamber at Treblinka because he was himself a prisoner of war in the Kelm concentration camp and remained in prison until October 1944. The only problem with the alibi, of course, was that the camp had been liberated in January. So he stumbled and flumbled, and quite frankly, the judge just believed that he was lying about where he was. So when Demjanjuk got to Israel, he came up with a new alibi. Well, I can't remember where I was during World War II, but I know I wasn't in Treblinka. Now I can see you forgetting little details from your past. But World War II? I mean, what's he got, Waldheimer's disease? A curia, an amnesia about his Nazi past? Now, he's the right Nazi. The Israelis charged him with the wrong camp. It was an unfortunate error because legally they had to send him back because it was an extradition request, and it must conform exactly to the four corners of the extradition language. Will John Demjanjuk get his U.S. citizenship back? Don't hold your breath. He's in the States under court order pending a new deportation hearing. He's lost his U.S. citizenship for fraud on entry. He admits that he did make up his entry background that he used to enter the United States and to get citizenship. He's lost his citizenship, and now the issue is, will he be deported? So we'll see what happens to him. When you look at it this way, even if he didn't kill three Korsumayim, if he was just a guard at Sobibor, it still makes him one of the greatest serial murderers presently living in the United States. Who else can claim to participate in the murder of even a quarter of a million people? The camps at Treblinka and Sobibor existed for nothing more than killing. They weren't slave camps. There was a small little staff to keep the machinery running. They were disguised railroad stations. Pull up at Treblinka, beautiful little railroad station with flowers outside. The Jews were told they were going to America, and they were going to be shipped to new trains. They had to, you know, go in and take showers, get cleaned up. We're sorry about all the confusion of things. Take your time, walk up. And they gassed them. It was all very cleverly done. It wasn't like Auschwitz, where everybody knew what the gas chambers were. Treblinka, they didn't know. Very efficient. And then they, at the end of the war, they plowed over Treblinka, put grass in, and put a little house on top of the field and told the Ukrainian farmer to sit there. And if anyone asked, they had been there all during the war. You know, the Nazis tried to hide it. You can't hide things forever. Himmler himself had told the Germans not to put anything in writing about ordering the murder of the Jews. Of course, then Himmler promptly sat down and made a tape recording of a speech. That tape is in the National Archives today, along with the original notes where Himmler scribbled in the text exactly what he was going to say. Talked about how tough it was for a German soldier to have to face 500, 1,000 bodies of the Jews. Only we know how it feels. They knew exactly what they were doing. Wholesale murder.
And yet we remain decent.
Yeah, what hypocrisy. One of the sad things I'm going to talk about in the next book is that 70% of the money to finance Hitler came from the United States. There were 20 American companies that invested heavily in the Third Reich. During the Great Depression, Germany was a great place to put your dough. When the mark stabilized in 1933, you could make a fortune. And some people made a profit on both sides of the war.
I just heard rumors that the Kors family has given a lot of money to modern Nazi family, not Nazi party. Have you ever heard of
that? No, I think the Kors family is just a typical conservative. No, there's nothing wrong or illegal about being conservatives. The conservatives have some valuable things to say, and we should listen to them. But a lot of people have been giving money to organizations that have done despicable things. Wackel, for example. And they have no idea where the money went. I think when this book comes out, a lot of people who had supported some of the Ollie North initiatives are going to be very, very angry and very ashamed. We were buying arms for the Contras from the communists. We were getting them from Polish factories behind the Iron Curtain because we'd get them cheaper. And then we were telling the Contras that they were really coming from Israel, who had captured them in the PLO. We were even setting the Jews as scapegoats up back even then. The problem was that the guy that we were using for arms deals was someone the British Secret Service had recruited. He was a Syrian PLO member. In fact, he was one of the leading financiers in the PLO, one of the major terrorists. What Ollie North didn't know was that he and Bush had put someone on the White House payroll who was one of the leading terrorists in the world, whom both the CIA and the Mossad were trying to find, not knowing he was working for the White House. And this guy was using his White House protection to become one of the leading drug runners in the world. So some huge embarrassment will be coming out when this book comes out. Like I say, Bush isn't a bad guy. He wasn't anti-Semitic. When I went through his skull and bones files at Yale, well, I didn't go through because they're behind locked doors, but somebody did. And George Bush voted in favor of having Jews admitted to this exclusive club at Yale. Now, his father and his grandfather were Hitler's biggest financiers in America. Young George dropped out of college a couple of weeks before his dad's companies were seized by the U.S. government as Nazi fronts. That's why he left Yale. And he redeemed the family honor. A lot of that's been hushed up for years and years. But we have a lot to say. I think we know more about Kurt Waldheim's background than we do about President Bush. But I think that's going to end very shortly. Yeah?
Will your book come out before Oliver North's election?
Hard to say. Probably. Yeah. Ollie, I think, is just a waste of valuable oxygen. I'm opposed to him for environmental reasons. He's a little con man. People don't realize that even after Ollie was given immunity, he continued to lie to Congress. Congress doesn't have a clue why Ollie was lying or what he was lying about. This Iran-Contra thing didn't begin in June 85. The Israelis had to be dragged into it, and the Israelis didn't know they were being brought into the deal as the scapegoats to cover up for a British gun-running deal that started a couple of years earlier. So we're going to name all the players, all the bank accounts, and all the lies that were told to Congress. It'll probably help Ollie's campaign. You know, Kurt Waldheim's vote went up in Austria after his Nazi background was revealed. You never know. All I can do is tell the truth, let the chips fall where they may. Yes, sir?
What other facilities for SS background research came about after the breakdown
of the Communist Party? Oh, yeah. After the, not just in East Germany, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, tons of the files were started to come out. We're finding out now that we may have undercounted the Holocaust by as much as 10%. There were huge atrocities in eastern Belarusia and Russia itself that have never been recorded or counted. We have definitely undercounted the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Gypsies. The number of Gypsies killed may have reached 500,000. It appears now that there will actually have been more Christians than Jews killed during the Holocaust. At the end of the war, they'd virtually run through most of the Jews they could get their hands on. They were killing four Christians for every Jew in the last moment. So it's interesting to see. You can see the trend of where they would be going next. I think that the more we study the Holocaust, the more we realize that this century will be known as the century of atomic energy and the Holocaust. There's been nothing like it in human history. There may never be again, I hope. But I was talking with Elie Wiesel a couple of weeks ago. And he said that, you know, it seems so sad. This century started with war in Sarajevo in World War I. At the end of the century, we're still fighting there. He thinks this century will go down in history as the most violent century in the history of mankind, that we have killed 50 million of our fellow citizens in wars during this century, that we have learned nothing from the Holocaust. I hope that is not true. That we have learned that it's wrong to conceal crimes of genocide for political reasons. I think the Russians now have got the great embarrassment as their own captured German records come out that have been buried now for 50 years. It's embarrassing to admit to their own people that where 20 million Russians died during World War II, that the Soviet intelligence services allowed, indeed encouraged, the Nazis to escape for intelligence purposes. This is a strange world. I'm sorry, I probably didn't answer your question correctly, but it's just all the Irish are full of blarney anyway. Yes, sir?
So what's the Justice Department's scorecard on those 3,000 Nazis that came from Belarus?
I think the Justice Department has a total of 60 cases that have been processed so far. You remember, it takes 7 years for each case. There are only about 10 or 20 lawyers that are even assigned to working on them. And the idea isn't so much to get all the Nazis. I mean, one Justice Department officer speculated that as many as 10,000 Nazi war criminals entered the United States all told. I think it's probably a good ballpark. More have retired here since from Argentina and from Canada. But the idea is not, you're not going to bring anyone back from the Holocaust to prosecute every Nazi war criminal. What we do want to do is to preserve the records of the Holocaust in American courts under American standards of evidence. And that's why I think that what OSI is doing is very, very good. I was just talking with the director of OSI, the acting director now is Eli Rosenblum. And as the Soviet and East German archives are uncovering now, OSI is actually firing more cases, that their workload has increased after the fall of the Iron Curtain. I would think of this one thing that we can all agree on is that Nazis are bad. Yes, sir?
Who decides the classified documents? Why can't they be open before that?
You know, Who decides to classify documents and why can't they be open for the year 2015? One of the reasons is I don't think Congress even understands that under the present arrangement, if the British government tells the CIA, don't tell your own Congress about this operation of these files, the CIA can't do that. Okay. The British liaison files have been buried for so long. For 50 years now, we have actually given the British Secret Service veto power over our congressional investigations. I don't think that's hyperbole to say that. That's a pretty accurate summary of how it's worked. Technically, we're supposed to have the files. Under the Carter administration, they're supposed to be reviewed every 10 and then 20 years. The Reagan administration threw it all away. They rewrote every standard for the Freedom of Information Act. They reversed all of the archives procedures. They cut the staff of the archives. It's just an absolute disaster. I think the Clinton administration right now isn't even in control of his own government. You know, the betting in Washington is he's going to be another one-term president, another Jimmy Carter. So the folks in the intelligence community are just sitting back, not taking any risks. You know, can't blame them. I mean, not many people are thick-headed Irishmen like me. They're going to give up their nice government job to go off and play crusader. Yes? I don't want to. It's going to be in the new book. Basically, we for the last 50 years, we've had a consistent program. I won't tell you how it's working because it's very clever and something that Congress has no idea how we do it. That we monitor telegrams and telephone conversations. Less so to mail nowadays. We used to do that. Major Jewish organizations, people to participate in Jewish organizations. All it takes to turn the computer on is if you were to call someone in Israel, if you were to visit Israel, if you were to belong to a Jewish organization. I mean, it got to the point, you know, B'nai B'rith celebrates the 100th anniversary of the Bill of Rights. I mean, that's enough. Okay? That can get you on the list. It really got way, way out of hand. This is stuff that was going on long before Pollard. Yeah. Yeah, and it will never stop. Okay. See, we have press in the room. I don't want to give away some of the most sensitive details of the book. I've gone through the CIA review, but we're still going through the libel review. Yeah, this stuff won't involve libel, but there is a very clever program that Congress and the American people need to know about. We use other countries to bug our Jews. Okay? It's a quick summary. The Secret War Against the Jews. My first book was The Belarus Secret. That was just the case study about the Belarusian Nazis and Saul. B-E-L-A-R-U-S. It was originally published by Knopf. I think it's out by Paragon Press and Trade Paperback. My next book wasn't related to the Holocaust. It wasn't related to espionage. It's called Valhalla's Wake, and it was about British intelligence operations in Northern Ireland. That was sort of fun. One of my old spy sources had a kid that got involved with the IRA in Boston, and they were running guns to Ireland and selling drugs to pay for the guns. The kid got disgusted and wanted to become a whistleblower. Next thing you know, the kid is dead or disappeared. No one knows where the body is. And all sorts of rumors and papers start exploding in the British press about how this someone in Boston was an informant and helped the CIA track these ships on satellite. And it was all, the dates, everything was screwy about it. The kid's father was an ex-CIA agent. And he arranged for his buddies to burglarize British intelligence files and find out that his son had been murdered in Boston by British intelligence to make it look as if it was an IRA hit because they wanted to protect a super spy that the British had at the very levels of the IRA. Sounds like a Clancy novel, right? So the government, of course, this old spy is my cleft classified, and when we brought the book out, people wouldn't believe it. Well, this year, the super spy in Britain confessed. So that's Valhalla's Wake. That's an interesting little thing. That's coming out. Then the next book was Unholy Trinity, very scholarly book on the Vatican, the Nazis, and Soviet intelligence. And it shows how Soviet intelligence had manipulated many of the groups, even inside the Vatican. The head priest that ran the smuggling network also retired with Kim Philby behind the Iron Curtain. The whole thing was just a Soviet sting operation. And then finally, the fourth book will be The Secret War Against the Jews. Previous title was Spying on Zion, but the publisher thought that half the people in America wouldn't know what Zion was. Probably right. They tell me November is the pub date, so it'll be in the stores like September, October. All I want to do is just get through the last stage. I mean, this has been a long haul. Yes, sir.
Did you come across any sources for
the most famous policy statement on should the Allies have targeted Nazi extermination camps and railheads during the war? My most famous was that would be the ultimate policy paper was the one written by Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy, formerly later head of the Chase Manhattan Bank. And McCloy just looked at it as a business thing, like a balance sheet. He wrote a document that's now in Yad Vashem. That's on the wall. And he said, why should we waste Allied bombers to blow up the rail lines? The Germans can rebuild the rail lines coming into the death camps. If you blow up the gas chambers, you know, what effect will that have on winning the war? Let us not divert our attention, but, you know. And, of course, he was quite wrong. You know, the post-war analysis showed that this massive bombing campaign did nothing, one way or the other, towards winning the war. Whereas if we had destroyed the gas chambers and the crematorium at Auschwitz, Treblinka, and a few other places, we might have postponed the mass murder of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. It was simply very hard to kill that many people that quickly. Yeah, so start with the McCloy papers and then work backwards through the Secretary of War to get the...
How about the British?
Oh, I'm sorry. The British policy at the time was that the Jews were just... They knew exactly what was going on. I read a lot of the British files.
Did you come across any mention of their evaluation of the photography of funeral burial
coins from Auschwitz? No, actually, there's been a misnomer. The photography that was taken in Auschwitz, the aerial photographs?
No. The ones that were found, this was a Polish Jew who had himself arrested, put into Auschwitz.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Oh, sure. I can tell you at the same time, the British government was reporting to us that we were fully aware of the Holocaust was underway. This year, I don't know, a small blurb in the papers about Churchill's diaries being declassified, and there are records there of how he was briefed by British intelligence about Auschwitz and exactly what was going on from 1941 through its construction. We knew prior to that time because we had so many agents inside the German industrial complex about what was going on. Auschwitz, remember, was a fairly late phenomenon. That the killing had been well underway in 1941, long before those massive programs were undertaken. The National Archives is after me to put together a guide to reviewing government classified files, because you can find out a great deal. I had Mark, I had him go through the Public Records Office in London for Schaeff and Allied Field Headquarters correspondence while I went through the American side, because each of our clerks censored different documents. So we're able to put together the full correspondence. And there's one where they're saying, oh, His Majesty's government has asked the Vatican to smuggle, to relocate the Greys, and the Greys being the code word for Nazis who are known Nazis but not yet identified as war criminals. The American response would be, well, shall we get the Greys out, or do we only have the Vatican take the blacks, the people who are unacceptable to our regular programs? And so they're discussing quite candidly how they're going to smuggle people out. War criminals. Blacks was the term for war criminals. Yes, sir?
Do you have any information about the human decision not to treat other people in the same
Louis? Yeah, the St. Louis was a ship filled with German Jews fleeing Germany, trying to find sanctuary in the West. Every Western nation turned them away. Once again, nothing that Roosevelt could do. Congress was the one that controlled the laws for immigration. Under our Constitution, only Congress determines the qualifications for citizenship. So during the war, what Harry did, and actually what Eleanor did, was kind of, what President Franklin and Roosevelt did, was to bring Jews in as POWs. We set up a POW camp in northern New York for Jewish children. And that's how we got them in. And even that was very controversial. Roosevelt did try several times, but the truth is that he wrote the Jews off, too. All right? It's sad to say, but that's what happened. His files will be released starting in 1995 from his archives in Hyde Park, and there's a lot of things going on. Roosevelt was in a very difficult position. One of the things we go into in the book was how could the president fight a war when a huge chunk of American industry was on the Nazi side? All right? And that's where the money was. Sad times. Yes, sir.
Are you familiar with the situation in East Timor?
Very much so. My co-author, Mark Ahrens, is the leading guy in Australia for publicizing the abuses of human rights in East Timor. East Timor is a Catholic nation being under siege in Indonesia by the Muslims. The reason is oil. East Timor has huge oil deposits underneath it. My crazy buddy Mark has obtained declassified comments of Australian, British, and American communications where they're saying, this is what's about oil rights, we're going to look the other way on this. It is ongoing genocide. Because it involves a tiny group of people, it is hard to get the Western press to pay attention to it. There is absolutely no difference between, and we say this in our new book, between what's happening in East Timor and what happened to the press's treatment of the Jews in the Holocaust. Yeah. Well, the Clinton administration, I think, is taking some better steps. Yeah, yeah, that's quite correct. The Clinton administration, for the first time, has mentioned that East Timor is a deplorable situation. But
because the U.S. has been supplying the arms and diplomatic support throughout this war.
Yeah.
And they're finally gone. And that's why Clinton decided to pay some attention.
I think the arms were primarily coming from the United Kingdom. That's one of them. Well, we'll see how the dust settles on that. But I don't claim to be as much of an expert on that as my co-author is. He is the guy who has been smuggling the press into East Timor, meaning with the resistance and getting the photographs and the film out. Yeah, he ran the radio nets down there. Yes?
What do you think of Wyman's book?
Really good. I want to tell Dave, because he's got the starting date of 1943 of when the American government first learned about the Holocaust. But if you go down to the Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence Special Document Index and look up U.S. Military Attaché Moscow, it will start saying that we were receiving the number of Jews being killed in September 1941. And Wyman doesn't know it, but some of the people he cites in his footnotes about the atrocities in Minsk and in Baranovich, those are guys from that I mentioned, the Belarus secret, that were relocated in this country, who were working for British intelligence before and then after the war. But I thought it was a wonderful book, brilliantly researched. But there's a classic example of what happens when the intelligence files stay classified too long. You know, Wyman's point is very damning, that even if we knew in 1943, that's still terrible, that we would ignore the Holocaust for two more years. To say that our government knew in 1941 is just obscene. But I'm afraid that obscene fact is the truth. Is the State Department and the British counterpart still anti-Semitic? There's a good book out called The Arabist that traces the history of anti-Semitism in the State Department. And I would say at one point it was, say, 70% anti-Semitic in the first third of the century, an astonishingly high percentage that reflected the percentage of anti-Semitism on Ivy League campuses. After World War II, I would say it dropped down to about 40 to 30%, and it went down to 20% in recent times. I'm not sure if it didn't increase, if anti-Semitism didn't increase under Secretary Baker. Secretary Baker, if you remember, when he was walking in to be inaugurated as Secretary of State, one of the White House aides said, well, you know, Mr. Baker, every American of office, every American Secretary of State has left office hating Israel. And Baker said, well, what if one started that way? The Baker regime was probably, next to Alan Dulles' time, the worst time for Jews in the United States. Anti-Semitism was almost officially condoned. If you don't believe me, ask Ollie North. In North's biography, North says that he was appalled at the anti-Semitism in the White House. Absolutely stunned by it. Yes?
A kind of rhetorical, philosophical question. Why now? All these people are now pretty old people. They have only a few years to live. They'll die anyway. Without anybody's help.
Yep. Good question. I get this all the time. Yep.
That's one of the
sure.
Yeah. The other one, why bother about Bosnia when we could wait and then bemoan the fact that it happened later?
Sure.
And then again say, well, they're all old men.
Yeah. If It comes down to setting a precedent. Sometime in the next 10 or 20 years, certainly in your lifetimes, the last Nazi war criminal will die of old age. Actuarially, two-thirds of the Nazis are still alive, believe it or not. The average Nazi is 2 years younger than Ronald Reagan. But these guys are getting on in years. Let's face it, we don't use them for covert operations anymore. The last covert operation we used Nazis for was in Angola. But why bother chasing these old men at this late date? They only have a few more years to live. That's exactly the damn point. We want the history books to record that on the day the last Nazi died in America, there was someone from the Justice Department there trying to take his citizenship away, trying to throw him the hell out of the country. Because the one thing that should survive from the Holocaust and the ashes of Nuremberg is this precedent that there is no statute of limitations for genocide. Most states don't have a statute of limitations for one murder. Why should we let people who murder millions get away with it? If we hunt the baby killers, the war criminals, until the day they die, there may be some deterrent effect. That is the message that we should have been sending all along to the Bosnians. If they had thought, if I engage in war crimes, if I fire artillery shells into a hospital filled with Muslim babies, just because they are Muslims, someday, if not now, 50 years from now, I may be caught and tried as a war criminal. I think that precedent is worth fighting for. It is really all that we have left from the Holocaust. We are fighting now for the history books, for those people who want to teach your children that the Holocaust didn't happen. Most Jews I talk to say, yeah, we talk too much about the Holocaust. And maybe you guys do to each other. But you haven't talked to an entire generation of children growing up in this country. All we got was six sentences in the Holocaust and all 12 years of public education. Let me tell you, I'm on the hate list of every bigot group in the country. They're doing a much better job of talking to Gentile children than you are. They're teaching the kids to hate. Very sophisticated networks, high-tech video stuff, neat little propaganda. And you see the skinheads that you're seeing are only the tip of the iceberg. 53% of American school children say they don't know anything about the Holocaust. Think it might be a heavy metal band. That ignorance is the fertile breeding ground for hate. Yes, ma'am?
I have one question about that. In terms of the people that they are pursuing...
It's a straight-out judicial analysis. In terms of prioritizing, you try and go after the guys who have the most blood in their hands. And the SS guards are the worst. I mean, they were the guys that were in the camps running the killing machinery day in, day out. They were the guys that say, okay, you know, all gays over this side, yellow triangle upside down, and you're the first in the ovens. I mean, they were absolutely savage. I think the gay community has so much in common with the Jewish community, with the gypsy community, with all the survivors of the Holocaust. We all have to make common bond on this issue.
Yes, sir.
Judging from the level of television, probably not. The SS was in two parts. The Allgemeine SS was the one that ran the death camps. Then there was the Waffen SS, where the soldiers were. And my apologies to the Marine Corps, but it's roughly analogous to the Marine Corps. It was an all-volunteer unit, armed military formations that fought on the Eastern Front. The problem is it's not the Marine Corps analogy doesn't quite work, because most of the Waffen SS units in the East were made up of people who originally served in local police units, the very men who had the most blood on their hands. So just because someone was Waffen SS doesn't mean he's a good guy. We changed our immigration laws in 53 to reflect that, that if someone only fought on the Eastern Front in the Waffen SS, he could come to America. All these SS guys came in, and now we're realizing, oh, geez, what a mistake. Yeah, they were...
Is that why they were the exempted group by
Nazi Nuremberg? Allgemeine SS, absolutely, just automatic arrest, because anyone who's in the Allgemeine SS was someone who was a suspect for war crimes. The Allgemeine SS includes such nice groups like the Gestapo. You know, really friendly people.
Actually, the camp guards...
They didn't want to contaminate the frontline units. It was considered a cushy duty to work at a death camp, and they didn't want word to get out. Generally, once you're in the death camp system, you stayed in that system, and you didn't go up and do frontline duty. But... Well, I want to thank you for your questions. It was fun being here. It's nice to be in Boulder, Colorado. Beautiful place. I keep hitting this microphone. I never was.